This is a project to do virtual, to do high availability in software using virtual machines. And to kind of set up this work on high availability, I'd like to start with a simple assertion. Fault tolerance is rarely worth the trouble. I think that the evidence for this is just that if you look at the number of systems that are out there that are really fully fault tolerant, that number is vanishingly small. I don't think this is because fault tolerance itself doesn't have value, I mean just the opposite, but it's just that the trouble that it takes to get really good fault tolerance is very, very great. It puts it out of the reach of most people even if they want it. And the reason that fault tolerance is so hard to provide is because you really have two approaches. You can either try to build fault tolerance into hardware, which works, but it's very expensive. Usually you kind of need custom support to do it, and it's out of reach of most people who are happy to use their x86 servers in their data centers. Or you can try to build your own fault tolerance into your software applications. And this is known to be very hard to get right. If you do bite the bullet and try to implement your own and test it and eventually make sure it works, then you're also stuck with maintaining that high availability support or the fault tolerance support as your application grows and changes, and that's going to require kind of continual expensive development and testing. Finally, to do this kind of support, you really need the source code. If you're an end user using somebody else's application, you're basically out of luck. So the question is there a way to get fault tolerance, which we think is desirable, in a kind of easier way? And we observe, first of all, that what we're looking for is kind of something with the simplicity of hardware but without the cost. And we get that from the virtualization layer. If you virtualize a machine, you have basically a hardware interface that makes it very easy to capture changes to memory or CPU, any kind of hardware level changes, but you don't actually need the hardware to do it. And in fact, at NSDI in 2005, there was a paper about moving a running virtual machine from one physical host to another, which demonstrates that you can get a copy of a machine to live in two different places fairly easily. So it occurs to us that for high availability, instead of moving a machine, what we really want is a kind of a continuous copy of a system on another location. So that's the idea, and how can we kind of go about doing it? Keep not only making a copy on another location, but keeping it up to date. We can kind of do this in three steps. First of all, if we checkpoint the system at discrete intervals, that gives us the ability to make up for the fact that the network link between a primary and a backup server is going to have much less bandwidth than you need to capture every state change in the system as it happens. So memory obviously can be changed a lot faster than that change can be pushed out over the network. But if you checkpoint the system, send that checkpoint out over the network, and then only then try to take another checkpoint, you can kind of keep up. The problem with, once you decide you're going to take checkpoints, you kind of need a way to maintain throughput on the system. You still don't want to be bogged down by that network link. So the next step to kind of maintain good throughput is to let the machine run while you replicate the checkpoint, kind of make the checkpoint replication process asynchronous, out of band from the running system. This means that if the machine is running between checkpoints, then there is a window of vulnerability where your system is kind of unprotected. If there's a failure happening, that state is not on the backup. In order to provide a really good safety for the system, what we can do is we can buffer the output of the system until the state that produced it has been committed on the backup. And by doing these things, we get a system with several very nice properties. First of all, because no state is ever exposed until it's committed on the backup, we're able to provide completely seamless failure recovery. And by seamless, I mean that if you have an application that's running on a system and your hardware failures, that application will continue running basically from the point that it left off on the backup, uninterrupted. And if you even have active network connections to your virtual machine, those connections will be maintained on the backup. So it's completely seamless, no interruption of service. Because we're doing this at the virtual machine layer, which we have the nice property of not having to know really about the hardware, because the virtual machine monitor takes care of that, and not having to know about the operating system, because we're underneath it. So we can build a system that's really completely general. It'll operate on any system that we can virtualize. This system is built on Xen. The idea is certainly portable to other systems. And what's really, I think, very nice about this this approach is that it's completely transparent to the system that's being protected. So if you are used to kind of other techniques like continuous data protection techniques where your persistent state is always replicated, then it's still your responsibility as an application writer to log anything that you need to do in the case of failure, and then replay those logs, recover from the state that you've logged on the other end of the system. So there's still a lot of work for you to do, even if you have some kind of continuous data protection. Because in this system, the application state is migrated along with persistent state. Applications don't have to worry about that at all. They're completely protected. And you can imagine, for instance, how nice it would be to be able to buy a system in a data center and be able to just kind of click a checkbox in your order form that says protect my system from hardware failures. And the data center provider can do this because they can install this underneath your system without you participating in the protection process. Because the system is checkpoint based, it means the backup doesn't actually have to run any of the application software that's running on the primary. The other kind of standard approach to fault tolerance is to take your input events, replicate those to your backup system, and then enforce deterministic execution on both machines so that they're both running the same instruction stream with the same inputs at the same time. And that way, if a failure happens, the other machine can simply pick up where it left off. But one of the downsides, there are a couple of downsides with this approach. One of them is that the work that you're doing on the backup is basically, it's being discarded most of the time. It's work that's thrown away. So that means that you've got kind of an expensive system running on the backup doing most of the time useless work. Another problem with the approach is that you need to have the primary and the backup need to execute deterministically, and this can be very expensive to enforce, and it requires a lot more hardware knowledge than simply what you need to in order to virtualize the system. So if you're running if you're not running the instruction stream on the backup, your CPU load is very little, and it lets you use configurations like these. You can have two servers that both have their own work to do, but that agree to protect each other. And this doesn't really come at much risk for them when there isn't a failure. When there is a failure, the workloads of both systems can be degraded, but they won't fail. And you can also use a system, something like a whole machine version of what RAID gives you for disks, where you can have several backups all share the same. Several primaries all share the same backup system. So that's kind of the features that this system, this approach gives you. I'm now, for this part of the talk, going to talk a little bit about how we built a system that uses these techniques and operates fast enough to kind of provide up to the second replica. I'm going to talk about three basic subsystems. First of all, memory and CPU, then what we do to the network, and finally, how we handle disk writes. Basic principle of operation is to take the system that you want to protect and encapsulate it in a virtual machine so that you can interpose on writes to memory, change to CPU state, and I/O access. And then once you have it encapsulated, you can use that to start checkpointing the state of the system, that's memory and disk state, at a very high frequency. And by high frequency, I'm talking about up to about 50 times a second. So a checkpoint every 20 milliseconds at a maximum, that's where we benchmarked it. And then we buffer network output between checkpoints. And when or if a failure happens, all we have to do is let the backup begin execution from the last checkpoint that it has, and everything's fine. It's a very, very simple failover process. So to give you an idea of what the life cycle of the system looks like, there are really four basic stages to maintaining your replica on the backup. First of all, step one is you pause the system very briefly for a couple of milliseconds to take a checkpoint of its memory state. And these checkpoints are incremental. That means that you're just capturing the changes since the last checkpoint. And this is we do this by basically using hardware page table tricks to make any writes to memory become, we mark all memory as read-only, and then if a write happens, we capture the fault, mark it as read-write again, but log the fact that memory has been changed so that we know that we have to push it out to the backup system. So we take a we pause the machine, we copy any changed memory into a local buffer, and we immediately resume execution of the primary system, but with its network output buffered. We then trickle out, we send out as fast as we can the checkpoint state to the backup, and when the backup has the complete checkpoint of memory, as well as all the disk writes that happened in that epoch, it sends a commit message back to the primary, which lets it release any network output. And that's only then that the client sees the work that's been done in that epoch. So effectively, the view of the server that the outside world has is a few milliseconds behind the work that the machine's actually done. Okay, so I'll first talk, I've given a little bit of an outline of how memory checkpointing works. The key things, key ways that it's different from live migration are that it buffers locally and that it does as little work as it possibly can. Live migration is a very nice system, but it's not designed to run several times per second. The whole process takes several seconds to run, and there's usually a period of 50 to 100 milliseconds at the very end of live migration where the primary and where the system is offline while the final synchronization between primary and backup takes place. So we worked a lot to cut that time period down as small as possible, but I'm not going to go into the details of that. If you're interested in how in those kinds of optimizations, the paper has lots of detail on it. So I'll talk a little bit now about what we do to the network. The basic idea, what we really have to always maintain, is that you never see any packets that haven't, you never see any output from a system that hasn't been checkpointed to the backup location. Basically, the idea is you don't want to make promises that you can't keep. You can't have the server tell you, you know, A, and then fail over and have to replay that work, because the system is, we don't enforce deterministic execution, so there's a possibility that when you fall back to a checkpoint and then try to move forward again to the point in time that the client saw, you're going to produce different output. So we hide that output, and if a failure does happen, we simply throw away any of the output that's been done. And it's actually a very simple system because IP networks, because the network interface is not guaranteed, does not make any guarantees to the operating system that a packet will always be delivered. So if a failure happens and we have to roll back to a checkpoint that doesn't remember receiving certain packets from a client, the client will send them again if it uses TCP because we buffered any acknowledgments. So just to see kind of graphically what the network buffer looks like, input packets arrive to the VM completely as they do in a native system, but any outputs are captured on the way out on the at the virtual interface and held there until the network buffer receives a commit message from the backup system. So disk is a little bit more interesting than network because we have to make much stronger guarantees about data. If the virtual machine believes that it's written something to disk, that data has to be on disk. And the interesting case for disk replication is not when only one machine fails, that's fairly easy to handle, but we have to also make sure that the disk contents are correct if both the primary and the backup fails. We always need to be able to recover disk state. The way we do this is that we let the primary write directly to its own disk. We don't buffer any writes or try to enforce any kind of epoch onto the primary system, but we capture disk writes as they go to the disk and buffer them on the backup location. And the reason for this is because the disk on the backup needs to be consistent with the VM checkpoint that it has, which can be a little bit behind the write stream that we have. So we keep them in a buffer. And then if a failure happens, we have to flush the buffer to disk so that, because at the point that the failure happens, the backup VM is going to be the state of the machine that the rest of the world knows about. So the state of the disk on that backup server has to match that. So we can't begin execution on the backup host until everything in the buffer has been flushed to disk, because otherwise there's a window where if the backup fails after it's begun executing and sent data to the outside world, but before that data has been flushed to disk where you can lose persistent state. So this system avoids that. The last little piece of the puzzle is how to detect failure. And we don't do anything particularly complicated here either. There's basically two kind of cases you need to handle. First of all, we want to make sure that if the backup fails, the primary isn't stalled. And second of all, we want to make sure that the primary fails, the backup knows that it can pick up where it left off. Now, because we're sending a kind of continuous data stream as fast as we can between the primary and the backup, it's very easy to detect failure simply as a timeout in that data stream. So if the backup fails to respond, the primary simply disables replication. And if the primary fails to respond, the backup, all it has to do is activate the VM. There's one other case to worry about, which is what happens if it's the network link itself that fails and both machines are actually operational. It's a network partition. And our approach has just been to use bonded NICs so we don't have a single point of failure. But there are, of course, other more complicated techniques available. So that's the kind of picture of how the system operates. I'm now going to talk a little bit about, you know, what kinds of overheads it produces and what affects its performance. And there are really two overheads. There is the overhead of actually taking the checkpoint, stopping the machine, which kind of reduces the throughput of your system. And then there's the overhead of the network with delay that we introduce in order to ensure safety between checkpoints. So as a person providing the service, you have one knob, which is how far apart you want the checkpoints to be. Depending on your workload, this curve is a real curve that shows you what the overhead is depending on your checkpoint frequency. The workload here is building a kernel inside of a protective VM because that puts load on disk and CPU and RAM kind of evenly. And you can see that it's sort of, you get a kind of diminishing return as the network delay increases, but the actual shape of this curve is going to depend very much on how much RAM you dirty. And you may decide to change this variable if your applications are more latency sensitive or more throughput sensitive. But that's the basic idea, is that this application kind of trades network delay for throughput. On the other side of the scale, what we're kind of curious about is what is the minimum rate at which you can checkpoint, and that depends entirely on your workload, how much RAM you dirty between cycles. So this is a micro benchmark in which we have an application that deliberately touches various amounts of RAM from 4K to 4 megabytes between checkpoints so that we can see where the bottleneck is in replicating data. The red bar is the amount of time it takes to actually take a checkpoint locally. And the yellow bar with error bars of 95% confidence is how long it takes to push that checkpoint out over the network to a backup on a gigabit link. Again, this is based on the kernel. No, sorry, this is right. This is the artificial workload. And you can see that the checkpoint itself doesn't, the time it takes to perform the checkpoint grows relatively slowly. So the big bottleneck is your network link. Anything you can do to reduce the amount of traffic you send over the network is going to let you have checkpoints closer together. One last thing I'd like to discuss about the evaluation is whether the system actually works. We've tested this kind of systematically by generating a workload that puts a lot of that does a lot of work on the disk and the network and CPU. This is several applications running at once, testing all these pieces. And then we've deliberately disconnected this primary system from the network, killed its power at each stage of replication. In all cases, the system continues to run. The backup takes over seamlessly with no visible interruption, and the process of failover takes under 1 second. So I'm going to conclude with a little bit of related work and then some future work. First of all, so this project is not the first one to use virtualization in order to provide fault tolerance. There's a very nice paper from Tom Bersuit and Fred Schneider in 95 that used called hypervisor-based fault tolerance. Their approach was to use a virtual machine in order to use a virtual machine the same way that we do, but instead of using checkpoints, they did replicated the input stream and enforced deterministic execution on both the primary and the backup. And most of this paper is actually about the trouble you have to go through to enforce deterministic execution. They needed to have a lot of knowledge about their particular target hardware, which was an HPPA risk, and they discovered things that even the hardware engineers themselves were surprised about their chip. So deterministic execution is generally much harder to do than virtualization. The other thing about deterministic execution is that it can be very expensive to enforce, and that's especially true on machines that have shared memory multiprocessors. There was work done to make this happen. George Dunlap did this a couple of years ago for his as part of his PhD thesis, but he discovered that it's often possible for two processor workload to run slower than one because of the work you need to do to order accesses to memory, to enforce ordering on accesses to memory. So our approach, because we're not enforcing deterministic execution, we're using checkpoints, managed to sidestep that problem. We have a lot of things that we're that are going on. We're making a lot of we're taking this work in a lot of different directions. There are several interesting ones, like kind of tying this together with a parallax project that we recently presented in Eurosys. This lets us take very frequent checkpoints, not only of memory but disk, and keep those checkpoints over a long period of time, so that we have a very fine-grained record of everything that a system has been done. Has done over a long period of time. And because the system's checkpoint based, it means that we can actually go back in time, instantiate any of those checkpoints, and re-execute from there. Another thing that we're doing in the short term, this summer, is we're extending this project to do not just fault tolerance, that's kind of two machines that are in the same same data center, but actually disaster protection. So we have one machine very hundreds of miles away from the other one. And this puts a lot more constraints on the kind of network connectivity we have, and it means we have more latency and IP routing issues that make the project kind of fun to deal with. But the primary concern is how can we deal with the additional network latency? And we have a lot of approaches to that, which we'll hopefully be talking about later this summer. So kind of to sum up what the project is, it's the idea behind it is to do fault tolerance in as simple and general a way as possible. And we achieve this by running as a service at the virtualization layer, which is ignorant of the hardware and the operating system and also transparent to the system that's being protected. So it's easy enough to just switch on or off with no other effort. And we think that's going to make it possible to give fault tolerance to a wide range of systems for whom it was previously unavailable. I'll leave our website up there in case anybody's interested. And of course, there's lots and lots of detail in the paper, which I have only just briefly touched on now. So thanks very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
Fred Douglas, IBM Watson. So I was wondering, your micro benchmarks focused on things like kernel compilation and also just something that touched a bunch of pages. Yeah. If you look at the effect of network activity and sort of high throughput applications and sort of how much this affects things, they're really trying to use the network a lot.
Yeah, sure. So network sensitive applications are going to kind of be hit the hardest by this. We did, in fact, test this against SpecWeb. And the interesting thing about the SpecWeb benchmark, this is in the paper, is that it's very latency sensitive. Kind of the more latency you have, the worse your score is going to be, regardless of anything else. And it also touches a lot of memory, so it kind of hits the two bottlenecks of our system. And the penalty was reasonably high. For SpecWeb, we were at about one quarter of native performance. And any application that's going to be, I mean, this thing is introducing, probably 20, 30 milliseconds of delay on a network. So anything that's throughput-based is going to have to, your buffers are going to have to handle a much higher, bandwidth delay product and so on. So yeah, network throughput is going to definitely suffer. But one thing about this approach is the reason we have network buffering is so that we can do completely seamless failover, not ever expose any state that might be lost by the system. But if you have, there are a lot of applications that don't care about exposing a certain amount of network state. What they're worried about mostly is not having to do recovery. Have applications do a recovery of state that they maybe kept in RAM. So you can actually turn off network buffering if you have a system that isn't really like doing transactions, but it's just kind of serving out data based on state that it's kept, and then you don't suffer any network penalty.
Not on. Vedat, University of California, San Diego. This is nice work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a question about the overhead. Do you have a feel for how much of the data that you're transmitting across the network wasn't strictly necessary for correctness?
We have an entire, we've measured a bit of that, and it depends very much on what actually applications are running. But it's a great thing to look at. I think we can cut out a lot in a lot of cases. For instance, if you have an application that's been doing a lot of reads from disk, those reads are going to go into rent memory, and then we're going to copy those pages over the network. And we don't need to do that. It'd be very straightforward. I think we're going to do this very shortly to, you know, capture those, when a disk read happens, capture the address that it goes to and kind of mark it as just clean but faulted in on the other side. So there's a lot of things like that that we can do by inspecting the virtual machine that's running.
So do you need pair virtualization, or can you work with fully virtualized hosts?
The current system is built for pair virtualized hosts, but it certainly doesn't need it. We just didn't have the new HVM hardware in our lab yet. We'll be doing that soon. It's actually kind of easier to use hardware virtualized hosts because some of the like the device model is better encapsulated by hardware virtualization. So like when we suspend, we have to kind of clean up the shared memory mappings that the pair virtualized guest uses for the network and the disk, and that goes away because it's captured inside of the guest state in a hardware virtualized environment.
Ken Berman, Cornell. So I want to question one of your assumptions, which is essentially that people want this style of fault tolerance. There have been a lot of studies that have shown that software faults are the dominant source of crashes, and particularly in older, more mature applications, that they become very dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you're going to simply reproduce exactly the bug that caused the crash, so your fault tolerance will fail over. Whereas in the stuff we used to do in the past with ISIS, or for example, the practice replication work that Miguel did, the effect of the sort of proactive reboots, or in the case of ISIS, where the replicas are not actually seeing identical execution sequences, gives you quite a bit of protection against software bugs that are sort of the Heisenbug flavor, where you've trashed a data structure, but the reconstructed version that the other guy's using may not be trashed in quite the same way.
Yeah.
Is there a way to measure that, do you think, or to get it, whether your intended client set will benefit from this form of fault tolerance?
Yeah, I think there's kind of actually the two ways to approach that question. First of all, I mean, I agree that this system only deals with hardware faults, really, the way it's built now, and those maybe are less interesting than software faults. But the nice thing about the system is that it's kind of like it gives you what you get from fully redundant hardware, so, and it's totally transparent, very easy to turn on. But I think the more interesting aspect from your point of view is that we're taking checkpoints and we're not enforcing deterministic execution. So if you kind of overlay a system on top of this that has some way of kind of after the fact detecting software errors, then what you can possibly do is set yourself up to roll back to an earlier point in time before that error happened on the backup and begin execution from there. So you get kind of that, you know, sort of micro reboot kind of facility because we're checkpoint based and not deterministic.
Have you studied that, or is that something for the future?
We're working on it right now. We have a system now that captures this system has kind of like the most recent checkpoint, and that's it. But we've already got set up in our laboratory a system that keeps like a fairly long history of checkpoints, and we have tools that are right now analyzing kind of this, the machine state of each of those checkpoints, and we're kind of looking at putting tools on top of this to do that.
That sounds cool. Okay, thanks.
Anton Burtsev, University of Utah. I'm kind of confused with your availability story. So usually in available system, you care about result, about output right now.
Care about which, sorry?
About output of a system.
Yeah, okay.
But you have a major assumption that you will buffer output until mm-hmm. you commit checkpoint.
Yeah.
And it's not very clear, for example, if you're protecting two virtual machines which communicate through the network, how mm-hmm. you can progress at all, because your round trip time seems to be equal to two times you need to commit a checkpoint, because once first machine waits to commit an output, then you send it. The second waits to commit output, then you send it back. So how does it work at all?
You're talking about two machines in the same kind of group that are working together on a problem, like you've got a database
yeah.
server. Okay.
Or available system where you care about reply right now.
like?
Yeah, well, there actually is a really nice way to handle that, which is to do coordinated checkpoints. And a guy in our group has actually done this on an older version of this software. Basically, you you tag network packets so that you can make sure that two systems are always in the same epoch. And then as long as you make sure that they're always, that their checkpoints are performed kind of in a coordinated way, they're free to talk to each other in without any kind of buffering between them. So you get, you know, very good throughput between those systems, and it's only external clients that aren't part of the coordinated checkpoint that need to suffer the penalty.
Thank you.